Talk today is going to be a bit of a retrospective, and it's not going to be terribly sexy in terms of nitrogen metabolisms, but I am going to kind of set the stage, I hope, for the rest of the speakers. So my talk today is going to be on N2O emission patterns during corn production, and my talk is three parts. First, I'll review some generalizations that have been made about temporal patterns in N2O emissions from corn production, fertilized corn production, obviously. Second, I'll describe a study in Pennsylvania where short-term mid-season N2O increases were observed in 2006 and to a lesser extent in 2007. And then finally, I'll discuss some possible explanations for these N2O emission spikes. First, some background. We know that atmospheric concentrations of N2O are increasing by 3 parts per billion per year, but reasons for these increases are unclear. Nitrous oxide is one of 4 greenhouse gases emitted by agriculture, the others being carbon dioxide, methane, and nitric oxide. Because N2O has such a long life, its greenhouse gas potential is about 300 times greater than that of CO2 and 10 times greater than that of methane. And it's estimated that 3/4 of global anthropogenic N2O emissions come from agriculture, so that management practices to reduce emissions from a widely grown crop like corn will have an especially strong effect on greenhouse gas budgets in agriculture. Okay, so one of the first reports of seasonal N2O fluxes during corn production was Hutchinson and Mosier's 1979 science article on N2O emissions from an irrigated cornfield in Colorado. Total N2O emissions during this growing season were 2.6 kilograms of N2O N per hectare, and this falls within the ranges of more recent studies of corn production systems. Hutchinson and Moser's study was also the first to compare measurements made with static chambers and micrometeorological methods that involved taking air samples at different heights above the field. So the static chamber methods are the shown by the line here, and the triangles show the aerodynamic methods. Generally, there was good agreement obtained between these two methods, and since that time, most studies on N2O emissions have involved the use of static chambers. Of the total emissions from the Colorado cornfield, 30% occurred during the 3 weeks following ammonia fertilization, and that's indicated by the red box here. 59% occurred during the first week following the first irrigation event. Now, these percentages may not seem to correspond to the areas under the curve, but if you see the y-axis, the log scale of the y-axis explains why visually it may not seem 30% and 60%. And Hutchinson and Mosier attributed this first emission peak to N2O from nitrification, and that was because of the availability of ammonia fertilizer in and the drier soils and the more oxic soils that would favor the aerobic nitrifiers. The post-irrigation peak was, of course, attributed to denitrification, and that was due to the higher water-filled pore space in these wetted soils. Now, smaller peaks of N2O were observed after each water input of 1 centimeter or more. These are also attributed to denitrification. In this season, Hutchinson and Mosier observed extremely high temporal variability in N2O emissions, and there was a 2,000-fold difference between the lowest and the highest flux in that year. Well, this is a simple diagram to sort of set the stage for our traditional way of thinking. The early season and late season N2O emissions here again are shown here, where the N2O emitted soon after nitrogen fertilization are attributed to aerobic nitrification. Later season emissions are observed after rainfall when the water-filled pore space exceeds 60%. And denitrification is thought to occur because of the slower diffusion of N2O through water, slower diffusion of oxygen through water, which induces heterotrophic microorganisms to use nitrate or nitrite as an electron acceptor during anaerobic respiration. And in many subsequent studies, either in the field or in laboratory incubations of soil cores, short bursts of N2O emissions have been shown to occur quickly following soil wetting. And the transient nature of these emissions has been thought to due to depletion of labile soil, organic carbon, and the depletion of nitrate or nitrite electron acceptors. Observed ranges of N2O emissions that have been based on the aerobic nitrification denitrification model are complemented by a recognition that the total flux of N2O emissions tends to follow the application rates of nitrogen. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change estimates that on average 1.25% of applied nitrogen is lost as N2O. So if one considers a typical application rate of 200 kilograms of fertilizer nitrogen per hectare, this would represent 2.5 kilograms of N2ON emissions, which is very similar to that was reported by Hutchinson and Mosier back in 1979. Fertilizer amounts are certainly a key determinant, but interannual variations in temperature and precipitation are probably more important in causing high variability in N2O fluxes within a growing season. And listed here are some recent studies of seasonal fluxes of N2O from corn production. And these studies here show a 30-fold range in seasonal emissions. Well, at Penn State in 1969, the Department of Crop and Soil Sciences established a crop rotation and fertility experiment to track long-term trends in crop yields. And in 2006, my colleague Jason Kay started measurements of CO2 and N2O from some of these selected treatments using static chambers. The cropping sequences that are being measured were continuous corn that were fertilized with ammonium nitrate and liquid dairy manure, and also corn, the first year corn following 4 years of alfalfa in a four-year alfalfa rotation. In addition to weekly measurements of CO2 and N2O fluxes, we measure mineral N pools and also take composite samples for microbial community DNA extraction. And if you attended Jim Prosser's talk yesterday on the newly discovered Crenarchaea, which have ammonium monooxygenase genes, you'll understand why we're interested in assessing the relative abundance of bacterial and archaeal AMOA genes in these long-term plots. So as Jim Prosser mentioned yesterday, archaeal AMOA genes are found almost everywhere that one looks. This is a photo of an agarose gel showing that microbial community DNA extracts from all the Hunter plot treatments yield PCR products from primers from both bacterial AMOA and archaeal AMOA. Bacterial amplicons are about 490 base pairs in size, and the archaeal amplicons are about 650 base pairs in size. So these reflect PCR products from a single DNA extract. Because they were generated with standard PCR, these products are merely a qualitative indication of the presence of both groups in the Hunter soils. And we are using these same primers with real-time PCR to obtain quantitative estimates of each gene group. And as Jim Prosser pointed out yesterday, gene copy detection is not an indication of active gene expression. That must be assessed on the basis of RNA transcripts. But nevertheless, our DNA-based results indicate that both phyla are present in these soils. And we are therefore interested in determining gene abundance in relation to fertilizer treatment and N2O emission rates. Now, what were the N2O emissions in the first year of gas measurements in the Hunter plots? The top graph shows vertical bars for rainfall events along with the temperature curves. The middle graph shows N2O emissions for continuous corn that's fertilized with either ammonium nitrate in dark red or with liquid dairy manure in orange. The bottom graph shows emissions for first-year corn following alfalfa in the four-year corn, four-year alfalfa treatment. Now, all four treatment combinations exhibited a sharp spike in emissions on June 29th, and that was the time at which 5 to 6 rainfall events of 2 centimeters or less had recently occurred. Now, on the other hand, more substantial rainfall events occurred later in the season, but these were not associated with these N2O emission spikes. So one possible explanation for the emission spike at this time was the growth stage of the plant. And this was observed by my co-author Arlene Adviento-Borbe, who did postdoctoral research at the University of Nebraska, again on greenhouse gas emissions from irrigated corn. And she had observed some, in some years, but not all years, some similar spikes in N2O emissions at the VT stage of corn. The VT stage is associated with the emergence of tassels and the entry of the corn plant into its reproductive phase. So in the Hunter plots, emissions occurred in all four treatment combinations, despite the differences in fertilizer inputs. And this suggested that emissions were growth stage related and that there may be some association with root exudation. Some evidence to support this explanation was that CO2 fluxes increased at the very same time as the N2O emissions. These two upper graphs are the same ones as in the previous slide, but the bottom graph shows the concomitant increases in CO2. Both ammonium and nitrate pools in the soil were very low at that point, June 29th. This is additional evidence that changes in root exudation at this growth stage stimulated depletion of the mineral N pools. Since this appeared to be a hot moment for N2O flux, we are interested in comparing the abundances of bacterial and archaeal AMOA genes, since we know that both groups exist in these soils. I can only show you quantitative PCR data for bacterial AMOA gene copies at this time, since we're still optimizing the real-time PCR for archaeal AMOA. The bacterial gene copies in these soils ranged from 40,000 to 160,000 per gram of dry soil, but variability was high, so high that there were no significant differences among the treatments. But once we have archaeal data, we will be checking for correlations between gene copy number and the N2O flux data by plot. What happened in 2007, the second year of measurements? Well, concurrent N2O and CO2 emission increases were observed only for the manure-treated continuous corn. The fact that different responses were seen in the four different treatments did not support our explanation that plant growth stage was exerting an important influence on greenhouse gas fluxes. However, interactions between plant growth and weather can certainly differ from year to year, and these interactive effects can also be important. So I'll conclude by pointing out that recent discoveries of microbial species with new types of nitrogen metabolisms should lead us to re-examine the early generalizations made by Hutchinson and Mosher that nitrification causes early season N2O flux after fertilization and that denitrification causes later season flux after precipitation. I also want to highlight the fact that rainfall and irrigation not only have direct effects on water-filled pore space, but also indirect effects on labile carbon supplies is mediated through plant responses to water additions and root exudations. So I would like to end by acknowledging Scott Harcum, our farm manager at Penn State, and some undergraduate students who helped us with the project. Thank you.
Any questions?
Yes, Peter. Yes, and I would say that the N2O flux after irrigation, yes, could certainly be, legitimately attributed to the classical denitrifiers. But the point is also that there are, you know, there is nitrifier denitrification that may indirectly be stimulated. So it's really difficult to say. So that's one of the reasons why we want to see the relative abundances of these genes.